Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. Today I'll be talking with Michael Allen Zell about City Crystal Soul Man, the most recent in his Bobby Delery series. We'll also hear from Lou Burney, whose new thriller, November Road, takes off from the Kennedy assassination and the Carlos Marcello empire. Michael Allen Zell is a novelist, essayist, playwright who's lived in New Orleans since 2003. In his Bobby Delery detective series, which began with Run Baby Run in 2015 and continued with Law and Desire in 2016, he's followed the cases of a Tulane criminologist and son of New Orleans returning home after Katrina. His most recent novel, City Crystal Soul Man, takes us deep into the heart of the city. Michael Allen Zell, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. It's a pleasure.
It's good to see you.
Yeah, you too.
So for those readers who are just tuning into the series, introduce us to Bobby.
So Bobby Delery is a born and raised New Orleanian. So that's a good entry point for anybody born and raised. But he, through his parents being divorced, spent a lot of his adult life in Chicago. So in the first book in the series, Run Baby Run, it was him returning to New Orleans as an adult after years being away. That helps for the people who may be new to town, the visitors, the never been here crowd. And then each book is a subsequent year. So City Crystal Soul Man is New Orleans 2016.
Right.
So this is Delery after he's been back 3 years. He's a Tulane criminologist, but at the same time, that head knowledge only goes so far when he's put in situations that he has to react on the street.
The busy mean streets, as
right.
we know. So read us a bit. Read us a bit to give us the flavor of this new book.
Sure. And this is right from the very beginning. Bobby Delery saw something shiny on his arm as he held his phone in disbelief. It's been 6 months. How in the hell? He muttered. Mardi Gras was back in February. He'd worn no glitter. Ellis hadn't used much beyond a little smear around each of her eyes. But somehow it kept randomly appearing on him. If New Orleans met its eventual demise, the only things left would be glitter and cockroaches. Delery flipped the speck off with a fingernail and took a deep breath. An ominous hush would have filled the room if not for the whoosh of the AC window unit. 5 missed calls from Ellis. 1 message. Frantic, her voice a roller coaster, to the tune of, Bobby, my sister's gone missing. She didn't come home last night. I'm at my parents' place. Vanetta's not here. Where are you? Why won't you answer? We're worried sick. Delery felt both empty and with a sore stomach, as if he'd been hollowed out and punched in the gut. As a rule, he didn't carry his phone during the morning jogs or workouts. But he wished he had this time. Not that he could have done anything much, merely to answer when Ellis called. He liked to get his jog out of the way before heading off to work as a criminology prof at Tulane, before the sun rose in the east, intensifying the heat and thick air that was breathing him in rather than the other way around. A primal breath in which humans were the inconsequential part of the equation, breathing him and finding him lacking, breathing him and weighing him down. He'd take a New Orleans summer over a Chicago winter, though. He didn't miss leaving 2 years ago at all. Delery ran his hand through his hair, hoping it would break his trance of disbelief. He felt like an adopted pet, unresponsive when initially called by its new name. This can't be happening. Not Vanetta, he said. Vanetta Smith was the younger sister and only sibling of his girlfriend, Ellis. She had had a few bumps along the way of life and school, but was hardly the kind of person to get into trouble, or not come home, or get taken. The thought scared him. Anyone could be abducted, even Vanetta, he thought. As he flexed his index finger to tap redial, the events of the morning and beyond washed over him both consciously and unconsciously. He jogged in the morning for other reasons than work and weather. It was a quieter time on his route from the half-shotgun house he rented on Dauphine up through Bywater, Marigny, and the French Quarter until turning on Canal to loop back on Royal.
Well, you had me glitter, as you probably know.
I'll mention this takes place in August, so that's the
yes,
point.
Yes, I know.
As locals may know, you find glitter months later.
I know, in my house still. And,
yes.
But then, from that moment to something urgent and life-shattering,
yes,
which is the way life in New Orleans can be.
Yes.
Now, what is it that keeps drawing you back to this form? You've experimented with so many kinds of books, but you keep coming back to this third time around.
I mean, it's one of my favorite types of books to mm-hmm. read. I think the form is more elastic than other genres out there. And I guess what I've tried to do with each one is where it's still part of the series and it fits as part of the series, but to approach it a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you could tell, this was a little different than the first, a little different than the second. And not just, I think it was maybe more comedic in parts.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the way the plot unravels, but it also, I don't know, there was just, I had a different vibe when I was writing this, and it may just be, this is how I felt at the time, but I like, you know, taking the reader a little bit in the same way Delery from each book changes.
Of course.
So by the time we get to the end, this is going to be a different guy than he was in book one. So he changes, but kind of the feel of the book is a little bit different too.
Well, every series is really a biography of the detective, of
sure,
course.
Sure.
Now, noir seems to be a form that is uniquely suited to New Orleans.
Yes. Yes. As we've talked about previously, you can't, as an author writing about New Orleans, you can't avoid crime of any sort, street crime,
mm-hmm,
public corruption, whatever it is. But the tricky thing is at the same time, you can't compete with the headlines. You have to have a different approach. And people have done what historically are different ways to do that. Mine is, I don't know, sometimes maybe I see one little kernel of something of interest, and then I run with that, and I take that way beyond. So I want the books to feel like the New Orleans that people live and breathe in to some extent,
mm-hmm,
but it's also, it's to the other side of reality at the same time. You know, I don't want it to be implausible, but I want it to kind of stretch reality a little bit too.
Right. Now, in this novel, you introduce us to one of the all-time great scam artists, Soul Man, who is beloved for his music, but he's got a definite shady side.
He does. He's always looking for the next kind of con he can pull. And this one is kind of unique. He enlists some pastors to work with him on this for a very New Orleans pyramid scheme. So it's August 2016, and he comes up with the idea that he will enlist these pastors, and they will sell tickets to seats on an ark. So when storm season comes around next year, then you have a guaranteed seat. You don't have to evacuate. You're just on the ark. He never intends this ark to actually be built in the first place.
Of course not.
So the idea is you put your money in, and then a few weeks down the line, you get X times your money back as long as they keep pulling people in on this. So the pastors that are part of this, one of them also plays into another part of the plot as well.
Oh, but the ark.
The ark. Yeah.
This makes me laugh.
Yes.
I mean.
Yes.
Now, you're making a real point about the kinds of corruption we find in New Orleans all the time, in the headlines, of course. And this seems to me, it is more comedic to be sure, but it also seems a bit more cynical.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think here was a different approach if you picked up this book compared to the other ones.
Mm-hmm.
In the first book, and that's going back then a few years, I was looking probably more pointedly at transplants.
Uh-huh.
Who come to New Orleans to turn it into the place they left rather,
yep,
than to come to New Orleans for the New Orleans thing. In this book in particular, and maybe that's where the cynicism comes in, was looking pointedly at locals. And from,
yep,
when I was doing research with Errata and had seen at the time and did interviews and talked to people how during the World's Fair, whether it was a French Quarter or whatever, it was a time of cashing in.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like there's a lot of cashing in right now by locals.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of the direction the finger's pointed this time. You know, if there's a finger pointed, that's probably where it is. And not just for the sake of this musician and pastors, all who were born and raised, but also Delery as he's jogging through the French Quarter,
mm-hmm,
and seeing what's happened with that. in particular, the bookshop that he goes in, that's gone. So that's, I think that's probably where that comes from. You know, there's a lot of looking in the mirror to go around. So this takes a different perspective on that.
So New Orleans has really transformed you as a writer in these 15 years, hasn't it?
It is. Well, I mean, I think New Orleans transforms people as humans just by existing here. You know, whether you're born and raised and have to grow up, you know, in New Orleans, mm-hmm. or you move here and you either are going to be the person that you came in as or you're going to change. And I think most people end up changing to some degree. I mean, ultimately, I don't remember, to be honest, I don't remember if this was in the book, but it was very conscious of me when I was writing, was that New Orleans is, for some people moving here or living here, it's a possibility city. Mm-hmm. And for some people, it is a city of limitation and constraint. And some don't recognize that there's that other side. And whichever side that you are part of says a lot about your world. And a lot of times people stay in that particular group. Uh-huh. But I think to fully recognize the city, and that's what I tried to put across in the book, you have to see both sides of it.
Yeah, you really do.
The possibility and the constraint. Anything to get out, you know, kind of thing.
Well, she's your muse, that's for sure.
For a lot of people.
Yeah, for so
a lot
many.
Of people.
We've been talking with Michael Allen Zell, whose new novel in the Bobby Delery series is City Crystal Soul Man. You can meet him Tuesday, October 23rd at 6 at the Garden District Bookshop, or Thursday, October 25th at 6 at the Alvar Branch Library. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. Appreciate it.
Bernie is a mystery writer who's been recognized with the Edgar, McCavity, Barry, and Anthony Awards. He's the author of The Road to Bobby Joe and other stories, Gutshot Straight, Whiplash River, and The Long and Far Away Gone. Oh, I love that book. In his most recent novel, November Road, he takes on the Carlos Marcello connection to the John F. Kennedy assassination for an unforgettable thrill ride of a book. Lou Bernie is speaking to us today from his home in Oklahoma City. Lou Bernie, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, as I'm sure you know, New Orleans readers will eat this book with a spoon. So what was the inspiration for you to take on this well-traveled material and make it your own?
Well, a lot of it is due to New Orleans. I went to college at Loyola. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Oklahoma City and then got out of Oklahoma City as fast as I could. And I wanted to go somewhere that was as different from Oklahoma City as possible, and I think that New Orleans fit that bill very nicely. And so ever since I landed in New Orleans when I was 17 years old, I knew there were stories about that city I wanted to tell. I met so many people, so many colorful characters, and I think in some ways this book was percolating in me, you know, since way back then.
Well, set the scene for us. The book begins with its protagonist, Frank Guidry, living pretty large in New Orleans, you know, but soon things change for him, and you take us to some pretty grim places with some terrible and some violent action.
Yeah, I wanted to focus a book around the Kennedy assassination, but I wanted to make the assassination more of a trigger for changes in people's lives than just sort of an emotional effect. So I started with this guy, Frank Guidry, who was one of Carlos Marcello's lieutenants. And he's the kind of character I love to write. He's sort of this flashy, charismatic ladies' man who's a fixer, who is, for me, a quintessential New Orleans character. I mean, New Orleans, there are no better talkers in the world. There are no more charming people. And so I wanted to write a character that kind of embodied that. And then I wanted his life to be turned upside down by the Kennedy assassination. And that happens when Frank, the main character, realizes he knows some things about the assassination that he should not know, and has to go on the run from Carlos Marcello and has to start running away from the life that he's always known.
And the key to running away, as you say in this book, is never stop.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of people outside of New Orleans don't understand that Carlos Marcello, you know, was the most powerful and most dangerous mob boss in America at the time. And so to run from someone like him is no small thing. And Frank, better than anyone, knows it. And he just has to hit the road and keep going and just hope he can run fast enough and far enough to stay alive.
And he chooses a pretty unlikely cover as he's out on the road. So talk a little bit about that other part of the story.
The second main character in my novel is a woman named Charlotte, who is a mother in a small town in Oklahoma with two little girls and a alcoholic husband. She's stuck in a really dead-end life in a place with a lot of dead-end attitudes. And she just has not been able to fulfill her potential. And so when Kennedy is shot, she feels moved in a different way than Frank, that she's not running for her life, she's running from her life. She takes off, takes the little girls, takes the family's epileptic dog, and hits the road too, hoping for a better life and a better future out west. And so eventually the two paths, Frank and Charlotte, converge in a line, and Frank sees an opportunity in Charlotte and her little girls to provide cover for him, like a way to sort of go under the radar and not be spotted by all the people that Carlos Marcelo has out looking for him.
Now, there's one line of the plot that is, it's a road novel. It's a rush, 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 escape, evade, just keep surviving. So that must have been a lot of fun to write.
I love movement in novels, the ones I read and the ones I write. So when you're on the road in 1963 America on Highway 66,
yeah,
it's such a rich territory. I mean, I remember stories. My mother grew up during the Depression and would travel back and forth Route 66. And her stories were so vivid about the painted desert and the giant Indians advertising motels on the road and the wrecks that people would have. And a lot of the stuff was just taken directly from my mother's stories.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just, I left out probably twice as much as I put in.
Now, did you go out and drive Route 66 yourself?
Well, it's mostly I-40 now, but I did do that. I did drive uh-huh. back and forth. And you get a sense of the landscape. And I love that there are still little bits of that time still existing, you know, a little motel here or there, or a little patch of Route 66. So it's still a very evocative kind of road.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it captures an American experience sort of like none other.
Right. Now, the other line in this book is that it is a fascinating and deep meditation on America as it was 55 years ago, starting with the grief that rocked a nation and a great time of uncertainty.
Yeah, it was interesting to talk to people who were alive at that time. If you talk to anyone who was, you know, 5 years old or older in 1963, they remember exactly where they were when they heard that Kennedy had been shot. And they each have an individual story, and they each have an individual way of talking about, you know, what that did. But the one thing in common that I realized was, like, how traumatic it was and how it created such a devastating sense of uncertainty. Like, I mean, this was at a time when, you know, nuclear war was, a very real possibility. It's when there was huge upheavals, huge movements, you know, in race and gender. There was movement to the city from the rural areas. I mean, everything was in flux in a way in America that it hadn't been for many years. And so I think people were just scared to death. At the same time, they were, some people, hopeful about what the future might hold.
Well, I think some historians have referred to it as a time when America lost its innocence.
I think that's a good way to put it. And it was a time when a curtain was pulled back on how things were not always going to be rosy and perfect, you know, in the post-war era. But I would say that for a lot of people, women and African Americans and people like that, things had not been perfect for them before. So this had a sort of a different effect on other communities that had been sort of marginalized at the time as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, the other great thing that you do is show that ordinary life does go on and people change, and all these characters have daily concerns that have nothing to do with that.
That was probably the hardest part of the novel to write. I mean, it's a thriller, but it's also a love story.
Yeah.
And people still are going to fall in love, you know, at times like this, and maybe even more so. But it also has to feel authentic. It can't just be one of those, a quick pause in the action for people to fall into bed. And I didn't want to do that. I wanted to make it genuine and sort of finding the right balance of that, making it feel real. Because I think that is right. I think life goes on, the heart goes on, and no matter what's happening outside.
Well, why is it you think we're still captivated by the mystery around this? Why is it you think people love stories about gangsters like Carlos Marcelo?
Well, that's a good question. Like, I'm fascinated, and I'm not sure I've ever explored why I'm so fascinated. It's something to do with maybe the underside of the American dream, this idea that there are subterranean rivers flowing beneath our everyday life, and particularly back, you know, in the 1960s when there was such a placid surface in some ways in the early 60s, the mob had an incredible influence. And so when someone like Oswald, this punk guy with no power, I mean, like he was like a warehouse worker at a school book depository in Dallas, is able to change the world, like I think that's going to resonate in a way that's very powerful in terms of like fate and destiny and how quickly, you know, things can go upside down.
And you're fighting against common images. You know, you have to create images that resonate with the reader that are different from the ones we all have in our heads.
I didn't want to write a book about the Kennedy assassination. I wanted to write one sort of on the edges of it, because I feel like writing a book about the man who killed Kennedy is less interesting than writing a book about the man who killed the man who killed Kennedy, or
right.
the man who really killed the man who really killed Kennedy.
Right. And if you've got that straight, no, I mean, and oddly enough, this is a book that for you in the writing of it had a lot to do with your mother.
Yeah, my mom was a great storyteller, as I mentioned before, but she also, you know, she grew up at a time when a woman like her, who was very poor, didn't have a college education, was married to an alcoholic, had very few opportunities. But she was the smartest person I've ever known. She was the most resilient. She was the most passionate, the most curious about the world. And in a different time with different opportunities, you know, I think she'd be running a Fortune 500 company or be a senator or something like that. And so in some ways, I wanted to revisit that with the character in the book, the main character, Charlotte, and say, like, what if she took a different path? And would that be the best decision she ever made in her life? Or maybe would it be the worst decision she ever made in her life? Because it's not a safe decision she makes. Like, she's caught up in something that very likely will get her killed and her daughters killed.
Well, everyone is so high on this book. It is such a thrill ride. I mean, did you have a sense when you were writing it that it was something different for you, that you were doing something new with your writing?
I think when I was writing it, I'm always just so focused on making the characters feel real and alive. And that takes so much trial and error and hit and miss that I'm really not thinking anything beyond that. Like, just, is this character coming alive to me? Once I finished it, I kind of looked at it and I was realizing that this is the kind of book I've always wanted to write. Like, I feel in some ways my whole life has been kind of an education that I can sort of lead up to write a book like this.
Well, and to think it all started in New Orleans, in a place as different from Oklahoma City. So what brought you back to Oklahoma City then? What led to the renewed appreciation?
My wife and I moved back to Oklahoma City for family reasons. My dad had Alzheimer's, and we decided to come back. And, you know, it's actually, Oklahoma City is a great city. You know, when you're 17, you want to get out of a place like this. But, you know, when you're a little bit older, you can appreciate it in different ways and for different reasons. So I love living here, but I do love to visit New Orleans. And the one thing I miss more than anything is the gumbo, because I have never had good gumbo anywhere but New Orleans. People have tried to give it to me, and it just doesn't ever happen.
Oh, you know, we love to hear that. Well, come on back.
Yeah.
Oh, we've been talking with Lou Burney, whose latest terrific thriller is November Road. You can meet him Saturday, November 10th at the Louisiana Book Festival in Baton Rouge. Lou, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Sunday, October 21st is the last day of the Friends of the Jefferson Public Library Big Book Sale. It takes place from noon to 5 at the Pontchartrain Center, 4545 Williams Boulevard at the Lake in Kenner. Sybil Morial signs the paperback edition of her memoir, Witness to Change, From Jim Crow to Political Empowerment, Tuesday, October 23rd at 6 at Octavia Books. Michael Alenzell signs City Crystal Soul Man, Tuesday, October 23rd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Anne Boyd Rue, professor of English at the University of New Orleans, will discuss her newest book, Meg, Joe, Beth, and Amy, The Story of Little Women and Why It Still Matters, at 7 p.m. Tuesday, October 23rd at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Maurice Carlos Ruffin reads from and discusses his work Thursday, October 25th at noon in the Tim Baker Auditorium at Delgado Community College. Tyler Bridges signs the updated paperback edition of his biography, The Rise and Fall of David Duke, Thursday, October 25th at 6 at Octavia Books. Poppy Tooker signs Pascal's Manali Cookbook, A Family Tradition, Thursday, October 25th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. River Road Publishing presents seven of their local authors discussing their books, Thursday, October 25th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The authors are Yvonne Spear Perrette, author of The Little Float That Could and Simon of New Orleans, Aaron Rovin, author of Little Laveau, A Magical Bedtime Story, and Little Laveau, Bayou Beware, Michael and Sarah Hughes, authors of The Tempestuous Trial of Maybelline Merriweather, Cornell Landry, whose most recent book is Good Night to De Parish, Alexis Brode, author of Bayou Ballet, 1-2 Rougarou, and Gumbo, A Magical Bayou Tale, Johnette Downing, author of Who Got the Baby and the King Cake, and John McGill, author of The Incomparable Magazine Street. Dogfish presents Rita Bullwinkle and Maurice Carlos Williams, reading Thursday, October 27th at 7 at 2448 North Fillory. Ryan Fertel discusses and signs his book, Drive-By Truckers Southern Rock Opera. That's Saturday, October 27th at 6:30 at the Church of Yoga, 1480 North Rocheblave Street. There will be free red beans and rice and a Southern Rock dance party to follow. The Louisiana Creole Association presents its annual conference, 300 Years in Creole New Orleans. Family researchers tell their stories. Saturday, October 27th, beginning at 9 a.m. at Xavier University. For more information, visit lacreole.org. Brian Kilmeade discusses his book, Andrew Jackson and the Miracle of New Orleans, with the historian Ron Drez. Sunday, October 28th at 1 at the Jewish Community Center, 5342 St. Charles Avenue. Tickets are available at Octavia Books. Tracy Duncan will be teaching a six-week course, Writing as Becoming, November 5th through December 10th, Mondays from 6:30 to 9, at the Dragonfly, 3921 St. Claude Avenue. For registration and fees, email duncan.tracy, that's T-R-A-C-E-Y, at gmail.com. The Louisiana Book Festival is coming up November 10th on the grounds of the state capitol in Baton Rouge, with a full day's programming by Louisiana writers. An important offering are the workshops for aspiring writers at the State Library Friday, November 9th. Participating writers include Suzanne Hudson and Joe Formicella, Josh Wheeler, Jonathan Everson, and Tessa Fontaine. Sign up now as these fill up really quickly. For information about fees and registration, go to louisianabookfestival.org. And if you're interested in volunteering at the festival, check out the website. Also coming up, Words and Music, a literary feast in New Orleans, takes place November 15th through 18th, headquartered at the Renaissance New Orleans Pere Marquette Hotel. Among the authors appearing are Leah Chase, Justin Nystrom, Jason Berry in conversation with T.R. Johnson, Kelly Harris DeBerry in conversation with Melissa Weber, T.J. Soul Sister, Kim Vaz DeVille, Allison Pellegrin, James Nolan, Peter Cooley, Nicole Cooley, Maurice Carlos Ruffin, and many others. Check out the Facebook page for more information. Join us for the Tricentennial Reading List every Tuesday at 8:44 a.m. and 5:44 p.m. The Tricentennial Reading List is brought to you by the Hellas Foundation, the John Burton Harter Trust, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.